Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We've had a number of successes with India over the past year.
Doug McCallop is chief ag negotiator with the U.S. Trade Representative.
During President Modi's state visit to Washington this summer, India agreed to remove retaliatory tariffs on certain U.S. agricultural products, including chickpeas, lentils, almonds, walnuts, and apples, among other products. The removal of the retaliatory tariffs will restore market opportunities for these U.S. products, many of whom are small and family-owned farming operations. This was following an agreement with India earlier this year to reduce tariffs on turkey, duck, cranberries, and blueberries. India this year reduced its pecan tariff by 70% on imports, following robust government-to-government engagement in February.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Welcome to the Council on Supply Chain Resilience.
Pete Buttigieg is Secretary of Transportation, speaking from an event at the White House on Monday.
When President Biden first took office, the pandemic had led to the most profound and widespread set of disruptions to our transportation systems since 9/11, including enormous strain on our supply chains. We were paying more. We were waiting longer. We had about 100 ships bearing down on those West Coast ports. And some in the media, just about exactly 2 years ago, were saying that Christmas was going to be canceled. Christmas, of course, was not canceled. All through the year, President Biden had been challenging us to stay ahead of this issue and to be prepared to respond. And so, as tough as that season was, we wound up having an all-time record high of goods moving through America's ports, and people received their packages from major shippers with about a 99% on-time rate. And now, as economists are assessing some of the reasons why inflation today is down so significantly compared to 1 year ago, many of them are pointing to the work that was done to reduce shipping costs and other supply chain inefficiencies. But there's more to do. Our goal is not to get American supply chains back simply to where they were before the pandemic, when they were fine on a good day, but brittle in the face of disruptions. Our goal is to make our supply chains more durably resilient and to bring more of their elements home to American soil to prevent disruptions and price spikes in the future. And that is why President Biden has created this White House Council on Supply Chain Resilience to institutionalize what we've done well and to focus on what remains to be done. From a transportation perspective, I want to briefly highlight three initiatives. First, through the President's infrastructure package, we are making unprecedented investments in America's supply chain infrastructure. We're helping expand capacity and resiliency at places like the Port of Miami, speeding the movement of goods with a new bridge being built at the Port of Los Angeles, adding 1,000 feet of wharf space and new rail cranes to the Port of Houston, and improving safety and goods movement at literally hundreds of ports, highways, and freight rail lines in between. And this is now being coordinated by our new multimodal freight office, also a creation of the bipartisan infrastructure law, so that our investments can have the biggest impact to move goods reliably and keep shipping prices down. Secondly, we consistently heard from private sector partners that to make the most of our physical infrastructure, we were going to need better data infrastructure. For example, an importer reported not being able to tell the fastest way to move goods. A port was losing visibility of goods outside of their gates, and a logistics firm didn't have enough notice to get their chassis to the right location where locomotives were available, all of which added up to wasted time and higher costs. So we launched FLOW, the Freight Logistics Optimization Works Initiative, to give actors across the supply chain unprecedented access to shared data. And today, even though this effort is still new, we can share some great progress. We've grown the number of participants to now include the 5 largest U.S. container ports, 7 of the largest ocean carriers, and some of the largest retailers, including Walmart, Target, Home Depot, and Lowe's. And participants are now beginning to use the data for the first time to inform decision-making that avoids bottlenecks, improves lead time, and better coordinates where trucks and chassis are most needed so that they can move goods more efficiently and, again, keep shipping costs down. And third, we are advancing the President's Trucking Action Plan, building new truck parking, improving working conditions for truck drivers, and opening new pathways for veterans to enter this critically important career.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We're going to be coming into tax filing season here pretty soon after the turn of the new year. And this is a case that is a case of first impression, meaning we haven't had another case like this. And now we know what the rule is on this.
Washburn University law professor Roger McCohen.
Let me take you back a little bit on this one. Back in 1985, the U.S. Supreme Court was asked to rule on the issue of whether you could delegate to somebody else the responsibility for filing your tax return. Who is responsible for filing your return? If you hire somebody to prepare your return and then it's not filed, is it their fault or is it your fault? And the Supreme Court put down pretty much a bright line rule, and they said it's your responsibility. You have to make sure that your return got filed. And that was, of course, in 1985. There wasn't anything such as electronic filing tax returns at that time. But now we've got a case involving that same issue with an e-filed tax return.
Are there times with e-filing where that issue could have been avoided?
Well, there is a way to make sure that you don't get into trouble on this, like this fellow did. What happened here was that his CPA that he hired to file his returns, and these are very complex returns with a lot of money that's involved, a lot of tax money, but his CPA failed to file his return for 3 consecutive years. And ultimately, you know, once he finds out he's got a problem, the returns all get filed. But he's got tremendous late penalties, $70,000 in penalties that have accrued over that time period. And he's way beyond the statute of limitations for filing a return. So that's where the penalty comes into play. And the CPA tries to tell the IRS that his tax preparation software couldn't prepare his client's returns because they were too complex. Now, I don't, you know, the court didn't buy that argument. I don't buy that argument either. Even if that were true, get a different tax software, get the returns filed. But he didn't tell the client that the returns had never been filed. And he also didn't update the IRS with the change in the taxpayer's mailing address. So IRS was sending delinquent notices to an old address. It was bouncing back to the IRS. They couldn't find the guy. And so after 3 years of this stuff, IRS finally shows up at his office one day and said, look, pal, you haven't filed returns for 3 years. And that's the first he knew about it. And so this mess blows up at that point in time. Again, this gets into court, and he sues for a refund of taxes. And so we're in court now, and he wants the refund of the $70,000 in tax penalties that he paid. So he paid the assessment by the IRS and sued for a refund. Well, you always want to make sure that your tax preparer is getting things done. And there is a document that you want to have in your hands, and it's very easy for the tax preparer to email that to you. And that's the acceptance notice from the software company that your returns have been successfully electronically filed. And that's really important because of what the court said in this case. They took that 1985 U.S. Supreme Court opinion, which said you can't delegate the responsibility of filing your return to somebody else, and applied that with respect to e-filed returns. So you can't delegate that responsibility to somebody else either. It's your responsibility to make sure your tax returns have been properly filed. And there is that document. When a tax return is electronically filed, and it's known as the acceptance notice from the software company, you want to make sure your tax preparer gets you a copy of that so that you know that return has been filed.
That's Washburn University tax law specialist Roger McCohen. You're listening to Agribusiness News, Markets, and Weather. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We're coming off a holiday week for one thing, which can be a little bit interesting given the short week and the shorter production schedule.
Caitlin McCulloch is director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center.
For the most part, fed cattle were hovering around 176 on Wednesday, and the five area no trade on Tuesday, and Monday was in that 175 range for the five area. Now, on the feeder cattle side, a lot of the auction data did not run the week of Thanksgiving, and so you're looking at kind of prices that happened 2 weeks ago. 750 to 800 pound steers in Dodge City were at 227 compared to 230 the week before, and 227 the week before that. So kind of sticking with that 230, 225 range on the heavier weight cattle. And then on the calf side of things, we did see some step down on the 5 to 6 weights, down about $20 on the 500 to 550s from the week before. We were at 269 versus 289 the prior week. And on 550 to 600, not quite as big of a slide, 264 compared to 271 that prior week in November. We are seeing a little bit of slippage there. These prices, though, have maintained fairly strong values heading into what normally is a relatively more depressed time period. And that has everything to do with the cattle cycle and where we are at in terms of how many feeder cattle are just generally available. And so we wouldn't expect to see like as much of a price slide this year compared to previous years, but that doesn't mean zero necessarily. And so you're seeing a little bit of bumpiness right now for this time of year.
But what about this recent burst of volatility?
We've been trading some really large ranges on the futures market in the last couple of weeks. And I would even argue since the previous cattle on feed report that came out in October, particularly on the fed cattle side of things, that report was largely a surprise. And we saw a dramatic sell-off in live cattle. And that trend really has continued. First, we had a huge sell-off the following Monday, and then we lost quite a bit more value. I think we were down at $1.16 a hundred on the April contract from where it was prior to that October report. And the market's really trying to settle out what does it mean to have these more placements on hand. And then this November report also showed placements to be above a year ago, but it was largely expected. And so that was a pretty big difference. The daily ranges on live cattle have just been extremely wide. We're trading, you know, up and down, you know, more than a dollar in some days. And so it's just been very volatile and probably a little difficult for people to figure out, you know, where the best entries and exit points are from a risk management standpoint. On Wednesday, at the time of this recording, which was Wednesday before Thanksgiving, the week was somewhat ending mixed. So we had some live cattle contracts up, some down, but, you know, how we end the week is probably going to be relatively close to that 170s range, which we've been trading, but that doesn't mean we haven't seen quite a bit of dollars trade on either side of that for the fed cattle. For feeder cattle, we ended last week largely down off the previous day, and those prices have come down pretty substantially too. So they're looking at about 230. Now, some of those contracts now are playing off of, you know, we have seen this large break in feed costs, and that allowed those feeder cattle prices to really run up throughout the year. Now, though, we have the situation where cattle feeders are replacing very expensive feeder cattle. They do have a little bit of a break from feed costs, but ultimately the live cattle price on the futures board isn't allowing them to probably lock in a profit for those closeouts in the future. And so at this point, you know, you're looking at probably some negative returns for cattle feeders in early 2024, and hopefully that'll turn around and that'll allow that feeder cattle price to come back up to some degree.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I've had the good fortune of spending 20 plus years studying consumer demand, consumer reactions to food and agricultural related biotechnology.
Dr. Jason Lusk is the head of Ag Sciences and Natural Resources at Oklahoma State University.
If I had to summarize a lot of that work very succinctly, I would say that most people in most places know very little about food and agricultural biotechnology. So as a result of that, what we see is how you frame questions, what labels you put on products, what framing you put around the topic, what information you give can have substantial impacts on whether people find food and ag biotechnologies acceptable or unacceptable, worth eating, not worth eating, or what, you know, premiums they might be willing to pay to either have or avoid some of those technologies. And so I think because of that, I think it's really, I think, useful and important to understand what benefits technology can convey in biotechnology. I think the research also suggests that the less foreign, so to speak, an intervention might be in terms of biotechnology, the more acceptable it is to the public. So because of some of those things, I've long thought that, you know, the answer to consumer acceptance of food and ag-related biotechnologies might rely in the technology itself. Meaning, can technology evolve in ways that create food and agricultural products that people can relate to, that provide more direct benefits for them, that occur in ways that seem less foreign?
Speaking at a recent Farm Foundation forum, Dr. Alan Van Deens, University of California, Davis.
First, I want to talk about, traditional GMOs or gene modifications. That is inserting a gene, whether that's from the same species or another species, into the plant, or animal, and getting, a phenotype from that. The challenge with that is the technology is actually quite difficult. It's limited to the number of hosts and the number of varieties or genotypes that we can do. It requires plant regeneration, and it's actually quite low efficiency. Give you an example, most products have had to have at least 100 to even 1,000 different insertions of genes before they found one that they really liked and worked well, say in canola or in corn. Those were some of the first gene edits in soybean, sorry, gene modification. Whereas gene editing is just like it says, you don't necessarily need to integrate any foreign DNA into the genome. You actually use things like CRISPR-Cas9, which is a group of enzymes that bacteria use to defend themselves from virus. And we sort of hijack it and we can say, well, maybe we can get this enzyme to only change a gene that is already there as opposed to insert a whole new one. And so that's a different concept, I think, in consumers' minds. And what Cas9 does, it cuts the DNA in double-stranded DNA, and it turns in where you can actually just rebind those two pieces, or you can actually insert a separate piece where that cut is. And it turns out that DNA repair system in plants and animals and humans is not perfect. And when you cut that DNA, sometimes you'll get a piece of the DNA missing or a small insertion. And so that's how it works. So basically, we're tweaking a gene that is already there, or we're inserting something at a very specific locus in the chromosome.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Since the last Farm Bill, we have made historic investments to address the unique challenges faced by these communities across the country.
Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow is chair of the Senate Ag Committee.
New funding for programs like ReConnect is improving rural America's access to affordable high-speed internet, creating new opportunities to connect people to jobs and education and healthcare. Historic investments in affordable clean energy and energy efficiency upgrades are working to lower costs and create new good-paying jobs in our communities. We've also made progress to address the climate crisis by providing historic investments in long-standing, voluntary, and flexible Farm Bill conservation programs. For years, these popular bipartisan programs have been oversubscribed and underfunded. New funding for the programs like EQIP, RCPP, are allowing us to finally address the backlog of initiatives and strengthen these programs. We also know that our farmers are facing traditional and novel challenges. While USDA projects that net farm income will remain above the 20-year average, and many commodity prices are at historic highs, so too are land, fertilizer, and other input costs. This is making it challenging for our producers to maintain their operations. Since the last Farm Bill, farmers received $70 billion in assistance outside of Farm Bill programs, including over $13 billion in response to weather and climate disasters. They have devastated crops, forests, and livestock. This is why I will continue to fight to expand and strengthen crop insurance and the Farm Bill disaster assistance programs for all our farmers. The future of our food systems rely on the investments we make today. The 2018 Farm Bill included strong investments in agricultural research, which helps our farmers develop the tools they need in the face of the climate crisis and other emerging challenges. These investments, as well as Farm Bill programs that support the next generation of farmers and agriculture producers, are critical to the long-term success of American agriculture. We must ensure that the Farm Bill continues to support the nutrition programs that serve as a lifeline to millions of people and families across the country. The SNAP program provides food assistance for more than 41 million Americans, 80% of which are children, seniors, veterans, and people with disabilities. The bipartisan 2018 Farm Bill directed a long overdue reevaluation of the Thrifty Food Plan, which had not been done since 1975, almost 50 years ago. This update resulted in a very modest increase to the average SNAP benefit of about $1.35 a day, an increase estimated to lift 2.4 million people, including a million children, out of poverty. Spending on nutrition programs does not rob resources from other Farm Bill programs, just as crop insurance doesn't rob resources from other programs when disasters hit and spending goes up. But threats that we are hearing from some, certainly not agricultural leaders, but some in the House, of reckless mandatory budget cuts will result in cuts to all Farm Bill programs, and I know that's something that no one in this committee wants. We cannot go backward at a time when our farmers and our families are counting on us to move forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So the cow replacement data has been one we're keeping a cursory eye on as we're trying to figure out how much heifer retention is going on, how much rebuilding might be going on.
Caitlin McCulloch is the director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center.
At least anecdotally, it seems like lots of that is limited. For one thing, there's still a very large percentage of heifers moving on feed. And so the heifer retention piece doesn't look like it's happening. But if you look at the cow-calf auction data, so this is largely going to be cows changing hands to move to other auctions, so less retention on singular operations. The Joplin, Missouri auction is showing volumes move up over 100% from a year ago. And I'm looking at the October data because that's what we have completed. And the prices have moved substantially higher as well. If you look at bred heifers, those are up 98% from a year ago in terms of price point. And then if you look at bred cows, it depends on if you're talking about medium and large ones or medium and large one to twos or medium and large twos. So medium and large one bred cows 4 to 9 months in October were up 34% from a year ago, hovering around about a $1,900 price per head for 2 to 8 years. But if you look at something like bred cows, medium and large one to twos, 2 to 8 years, 4 to 9 months bred, those are up 50% from last year from a price perspective. Now, they are a little bit less expensive, $1,500 per head, so maybe not quite what we saw back in 2014 yet. Bred cows, medium and large, they're up about 56%. Hares, 72% higher than a year ago in October for calves weighing less than 150 pounds. Those are now at 2,200 in Joplin, Missouri. And then stock cows showing very strong gains. Under 2 years, 40% higher than a year ago in October. 2 to 4 years for stock cows, medium and large, one to twos, up 77% from a year ago. So these prices are continuing to build. Some producers are obviously looking at expanding the number of head that they have on their operation and are using some of these auctions to backfill that where they have the resources available to them. Looking at Colorado, those replacement volumes are up 260% from last year. Now, this is a pretty big replacement auction compared to Joplin. The early November data only through 3 weeks is up to over 6,000 head. But in October, it was a little bit smaller, 1,200 head, and that's still up again 260% from a year ago. In terms of price perspective, a little bit less in October than the Joplin comparisons. We don't have nearly as much data, but it does look like November we'll see quite a bit more head move through there in that category. But if we look at 4 to 6 months bred for medium, for bred cows, medium and large one to twos, they're up anywhere from 25% to 40%, depending on what age bracket you're looking at. 2 to 4 years is up 40%, or 5 to 8 years is up 24%. Over 5 years is up 40% from a year ago from a price perspective. And generally speaking, I would say this auction is looking at a little bit lower per head values than the Missouri auction, but still substantially higher than a year ago and moving that direction. And I would really only expect these prices to continue to grow relative to last year as we move deeper into this cattle cycle. If you're looking at stock cows, those numbers are up more like 21 or 33% from a year ago in Colorado. And then your pairs are looking at something closer to 20% higher. So it somewhat just depends what you're looking for and what there is offered at the time.
It's Agriculture Today.